Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and the very lovely Ivana Popoff.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome back, Ivana. You're becoming a bit of a regular on the show.
Yes, it looks like it.
I've invited you back because I think your words speak to people. And I was lucky enough to be in the audience on Friday night when you were performing at the Ventnor Exchange. And you did some lovely new work that I think deserves to be shared with a bigger audience. I was hoping we could explore some of your poems and the thoughts behind them, because they're not just words on a page. They've got such meaning. And I, as I've said before, I think they speak to a lot of people. So perhaps we could start with some of your new work.
Yeah. That would be a pleasure. I'll start with the new one that I read on Friday at the Ventnor Exchange. And there's a bit of a backstory to this one. So I've been a bit of a guinea pig for a sound therapist in training.
Right.
And it's been a really enjoyable, insightful experience. And one of the subjects which has kept coming up again and again each week, we did four sessions together, was this subject of bravery and sort of imagining how wonderful and how magical life could be if we did exactly what we wanted to do all of the time, without fear. So this poem is about that. Shall I just start?
Yes, please.
Okay. It's called Why Don't You Just Try It, or Liberating Barbie. What does it feel like, she whispered, when you imagine that? My face gave truth, more honest than any word, a smile so wide it hurt. Like this, I whispered, pressing thumbs into the corners of smile, where two silver hooks ached under miles of thread, pulling up, 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 pulled up by a bird that was not taught fear. And through my mind flashed possibility, 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 possible, my ability to say, do, be, live, exactly what I felt was there already, had been before the beginning. I remember being given a Barbie doll at 7. I was pinker then, more orange, too, by a man with a black ponytail and a beard that was just too sculpted. At 7, it was simple. Ugh, I hate Barbies, I exclaimed, wrinkling my nose at the perfect skin, the permanent line around the lips, eyes. Disproportion lay in two long legs, perfect toes. Where was the fold of skin below? Disproportion. At 7, I already smelt something fishy in that frozen smile, so I cut off all her hair. Liberating Barbie from the silky blonde shackles. Heck, I gave her war paint, a toothpick sword, around her wrists a plastic bag, and she flew without a word from the fourth floor. This bare-bottomed goddess landed with a squeak that sounded something like freedom. I remember writing a letter when I was 10. Dear Zach, you are brilliant. Never let anyone tell you otherwise. And if you ever feel low or lonely, remember, I love you just as you are. I wrote that, I did, in one exhalation of my tiny lungs, and handed it to a boy named Zach without worrying. What does it feel like, she whispered, when you imagine doing exactly what you want, being exactly what you feel? My eyes gave truth, more honest than any thought, a peace so deep it caught my breath.
Thank you. Thank you. So there's a couple of themes in there that I think are very interesting. What was the consequences then of you doing exactly what you wanted and setting Barbie free and effectively throwing her out of the window?
Yeah, well, I was honest with this man for a start.
Okay.
Which meant I was honest with myself. I was definitely like scolded for it afterwards by my parents, because that was a very rude thing.
So you did this in front of the person who'd given you the doll?
Well, I told him that I hated Barbies and that I was going to cut her hair off. And how could, you know, basically at 7, how could he be so silly to think that I that I would like a Barbie. He didn't witness what happened to Barbie next.
No. How did he react when you said you hated Barbie?
Oh, he was really shocked and I think appalled at my brutal honesty. I mean, it was a gift that he'd given me, all wrapped up. He'd obviously taken the time to.
So you didn't have your gift face on, clearly?
No, not at all. No.
The well-practiced honed. No. Oh, it's lovely.
Yeah, I hadn't learnt that yet.
Have you learnt it now?
Yeah, I think so. And that makes me a bit sad.
Indeed. She scolded you. And then how did that go from there in subsequent gifts? Was she very mindful of what she gave you, or was she less inclined to give you anything at all?
I'm sorry, Mum has always been pretty pants with presents.
Okay.
She hates shopping, and so does my dad. So I think they just want to get it done as quickly as possible. I've had a lot of socks in my time. Lots of
socks.
Do
you think that's retribution for what you did to Barbie, looking back?
Maybe. I don't know. It was someone else who gave me Barbie. So Mum was just kind of embarrassed, I think, as the mother of this friend. Sorry, mother of me, friend of the family. But yeah, I've had a lot of socks.
So going back to the bravery, what's the bravest thing that you think you've ever done in your life?
Probably the moments when I've had the guts to tell a boy that I love them. It's never gone well.
That was going to be my next question.
It's never gone well. Well, actually, it could always have gone worse. I've had some funny reactions.
What was the best one?
I think the best, I've been travelling with a guy named Arwin from Australia for about 3 months, and I was hopelessly in love, but we were also like best friends, hanging out every day, doing everything together, and I just told him one day, and he said, "Wow, you've got balls."
Okay, yep. Not the response you were hoping for, probably.
No, and he said he was expecting something. He was expecting me to either tell him that I loved him or hated him, so that he was very pleased that it was the former.
And was it reciprocated?
Didn't go anywhere. No, but I think one day he'll realise, how cool I am.
That you were the one. Yeah. You were the one that got away.
Yeah, one day. I don't know where he is now. I think he's on the west coast of Canada or something, but one day, maybe.
Bravery is a funny thing, isn't it? I suppose one can imagine they're being brave when in fact others could see it as, it's kind of foolish or blatant disregard or interfering.
Yeah.
It's an odd one, isn't it? And what you think you're being terribly courageous can be totally misjudged by even the reciprocant in a way.
Especially.
So, and for me, when I heard it, it may have not been what you meant, but I was picking up sort of overtones of feminism there with the cutting her long blonde tresses off, Barbie's long blonde tresses.
It was sort of, I guess I was thinking more about how we're always taught to be okay. You know, there's a reference to her perfect smile, which is just constantly
there.
Yeah. When underneath, I mean, I'm sure that underneath there's probably not a lot going on inside a Barbie doll, but for us, humans, very often we're struggling with stuff, but we're taught to keep smiling and to be okay and to not talk about our darkest demons.
No.
So it's sort of about that as well, kind of liberating ourselves from this pressure of having to be okay all of the time, which is an awful pressure.
It is a stress, and I think when people behave like that, the trouble is one thinks that everybody else is coping so amazingly well and you're the only one that's stumbling around in the darkness, not knowing what to do and keeping it all in and, like you say, painting on this smile.
That probably we're all stumbling in the darkness, aren't we?
The trouble is I also think, though, that when people do let out their demons or discuss the darker side, though we all say, yes, we should do this, when somebody actually does it, you think, no, don't do that. I really can't cope. Yeah, I'm struggling enough on my own. and I you kind of see that look of fear in someone's eyes if you do kind of start to sort of draw back the curtain. And I think that's probably quite terrifying for the other person. So then we all go back to putting on the fine. I'm fine. That is the yes, it'll all be fine. Yeah. It's fine. I hate that phrase. I think that's become the scourge of this day and age. Everybody just saying, oh, it's all fine, it'll all be fine, because so often it's not fine, is it? Is anything but fine?
And I think I don't know, I think a lot of our mental health issues could be dealt with and sort of worked through in a much healthier way if we were open about everything that we're struggling with.
Yes.
All of the time. I mean, you would never hesitate if someone asked you how you were feeling and you had an upset stomach, so like an imbalance of chemicals in your digestive system, to say, oh, actually, like, but if we have an imbalance of chemicals in our brain, then it's a completely different thing,
It's just hard for other people to cope, particularly if they're having a really good day. They think, oh, please don't rain on my parade. I've struggled all week and today I finally coped with it. So I think that might be part of it. So do you use your writing? I mean, having heard it, I would imagine you use your writing as a form of therapy.
Yeah, it is very therapeutic. Usually afterwards, when I can read back and sort of realise, oh, I had that thought, or I had that feeling, or I observed this funny little thing. All these things which would maybe be lost if they weren't written down. While I'm writing this, I don't feel like there's a lot going on. Maybe there is, it all sort of comes out in one vomit, but it's more afterwards when I read over them again or share them with other people and get positive feedback. And
It's interesting you've used the word that came out in one vomit. But your work is anything but putrid. You know, it's very beautiful. So it's interesting to me that that's how you...
I guess vomit in the sense that I don't rework them.
You don't
or edit them. They just come out in one go when the moment's right, and then that's it. Maybe I'll change a few words or jiggle with the rhythm.
So for you it's a very fast process then?
Yeah, like a matter of minutes.
Ah, it's beautiful that you can create that in such a short space of time.
But I guess I've been brewing on them for a while, probably.
And when you share them, I suppose it's like any art form, there's what the artist's thoughts and feelings behind the work, and then there's those of the audience and how they reinterpret and what they see and what they read into.
Yeah.
So have you had some interesting reactions?
Well, it was interesting just a minute ago that you kind of latched onto the like this issue of feminism within that poem, because that wasn't at the forefront of my mind when I wrote it, but I'm sure a lot of people would think that also.
I think it's that name Barbie, isn't it?
Yeah,
it brings that
symbolic,
up straight away as adults, not when you're a child, but as an adult. That doll is always used to represent anti-feminism.
Prisoner, isn't she?
Yes.
There's a few poems that I've kind of been reading quite sincerely, and that people have found really funny, and then I realise how funny they are, and then I can play with it. So that's... And then the other way round, like I'm speaking tongue in cheek. I'm really taking the mic, and people think I'm being sincere, and then don't quite get it. So the audience has a big part to play always.
I think when one just reads the words on the page, and you've only then got your interpretation of it as the reader, but having seen you perform, like you say, then there's another layer. We can see where you're coming from with the mood of the moment, really.
Yeah.
And perhaps does that change depending on the audience's reaction?
Definitely, yeah. If I'm not feeling it from the audience, then I'm very quick to sort of rush through. There'll be less emotion, less enjoyment from me. But if I'm getting good feedback and laughter, then I can really enjoy it and sort of slow down and...
And how long have you been performing now?
I started performing in my second year of university, so that would have been 2010.
So six years.
So 6 years, but on and off.
And how do you feel you've changed in that time?
Well, I feel like I was going to vomit before a performance 6 years ago and be sort of shaking and, like, you know, I wouldn't be able to read the paper. I'd be shaking so much, sweating. And now I really enjoy it. Like, again, it depends on the audience. I had a weird gig on Sunday evening. And, yeah, just sort of rushed through that one.
Yes.
Just wasn't feeling it.
It's really amazing how the audience has such a huge impact, isn't it? You can't just do the same set to an audience you feel is less receptive in a way. But it's, I think, perhaps some of that as performers, that's in our own minds, because it's like that in your head, you kind of intellectualise it and you might think, oh, that's clever, or that's funny, but not laugh out loud. Yeah. But you're having that reaction. Yeah. But sadly, as an audience, it's not being conveyed to the performer. Yeah. And then as performers, I suppose we are duty-bound to give of our best each time.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean about that rushing, and then it goes into this downward spiral, doesn't it?
Spiral. We're all self-doubting as well. I mean, we read into silence. Might not read into it, thinking, like, wow, these people are in awe, like, they're speechless, they can't even laugh, they're so, but no, it's straight to self-doubt.
Yes, yes, which is very damaging and not necessarily true at all, is it? It's our interpretation of something, and yet we know when we're in that audience and we don't react, it doesn't necessarily mean anything at all. We could be having a lovely time, we're just quite impassive.
So
going back to the feminism, it just in general, how did you see yourself growing up? Did you see yourself as equal to the when you were at university or at school? Did you see yourself on a par with boys and men?
There was never any conscious comparison going on, like, at an academic level. And our classes at uni were always so mixed, such a mix of male and female lecturers as well, that that really wasn't at the forefront of my mind. I mean, it was an issue that we discussed a lot, because I studied literature and then anthropology, so that topic was always coming up, especially in social anthropology, when you're kind of observing different societies and cultures, and that maybe still have quite different approaches to men and women, still quite segregational, or can you say that? Segregation?
No, you just have. It's fine.
But for me, it was never...
Never an issue?
No conscious complexes around it, or feelings of, like, having to kind of fight my corner, stand my ground, or...
Yeah, I think when... I'm a bit older than you, but when I was younger, it never came up in that. I think my mother always just assumed that I would be just the same as the boys in that sense. And it was only years later, when I entered what was then a very sexist profession, advertising, when it became something, a thing.
Yeah.
And I find it quite shocking and sad that it's still being talked about now, that, you know, women are still being subjected to this so far down the line, when you think, really, I think we're done with this, aren't we? But it doesn't...
There's so far to go.
It's still so prevalent,
especially if you look at wages and, like, hierarchy within organisations and different positions that are filled by predominantly men.
Yeah.
In the advertising world, it's probably...
And it was always things like, I thought, I'm not going to go and make tea for anybody, ever. Because once I do that, that's how I will be seen. Yeah. And that was almost, you know, you thought, that's how the role that's been put upon me, that I am expected to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to do that.
Because
once I start that, that's the slippery slope.
Did you never make tea then for anyone?
Not in a boardroom situation. Okay. No, I didn't.
That takes a lot of strength. I'm like one of the first people to go.
I just sat there and ate the biscuits of honour. I had a bigger draw. But it's going back to Barbie. There are still women out there who are paying a lot of money, plastic surgery wise, to look like Barbie.
Oh, billions of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember the first one, which was, I can't remember, 15, 20 years ago, I read about it and was so shocked and horrified, and just thought it was a bit of a one-off. But it's a thing, isn't it? Again, people want, they aspire,
yes,
and will do anything at whatever cost. Yeah. emotionally, physically, financially, to look like this heroine in a way.
Because also, I mean, we've been told, or certain people have been told, that it's sexy, that it will give you power, you know, it will attract people's attention. But Barbie's got an empty head.
An empty head, you know, yeah. And an empty heart.
An
empty, yeah.
Speaking of plastic surgery, it just came to my mind. In Japan, it's very popular for women who are aspiring to be as tall as Western women to have their... Is it the femurs? What's that long bone?
Yes, I think
the femurs snapped in half and extensions put in. That's one of the biggest practices in that.
So this makes them taller?
Plastic surgery, yeah, to make them taller.
Ah, because, you know, I mean, I'm 5'1", so you think...
Well, maybe you should think about having your femurs
no,
snap.
Thank you. They think, well, that's something you've just got to suck up, get on with, wear platforms, wear high heels if you must, but that is, you are stuck with that. Pretty much everything else you can change, but you are stuck with that.
Oh, no, you can change that now.
That's just terrific.
It's crazy, isn't it?
And that's in Japan.
In Japan, it's very popular. And, yeah, in a lot of kind of Asian...
Wow.
Countries with this aim to be more Western. And that's where you see also kind of them operations that they'll have on their eyelids.
Yes.
So that they can have a Western eyelid.
Isn't that sad?
And all sorts of, strange procedures.
Yeah, I wonder when this is all going to come back and bite us all. Because you never know the long-term effects, either mentally or physically, on that kind of... body changing procedure. Yeah. It's huge, isn't
it's massive.
It? Yeah, in every sense.
Ripples.
Yeah. It's like Botox. I mean, I've got nothing against anybody that does it, but I just couldn't, because I fear long term effects. Really. So I'm just going to kind of look like an old crow for years. And just get worse and worse and worse.
But they're lines of expression, aren't they? And it's part of your story.
It is part of your story.
Face,
it's not a very pretty... It's a rather ugly story.
No, I think they're quite lovely. Like when people have crow's feet and you can tell they've smiled.
They've lived a life.
You know?
Yeah. But that, unfortunately, it's becoming equally... people are equally obsessed with getting rid of that and making everything bland, aren't they? And literally faceless. And becoming everybody having the same type of plastic surgery, so everybody lands up looking like a version of one another.
Yeah.
So nobody's got that individual look and feeling, which is really, I don't know, I think it's quite debilitating, isn't it? It's a loss of you, isn't it?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to take a short break now, but stay tuned and let's hear more from Ivana, more of her lovely words after the break. Thank you.
The Lunchtime Social Debate is sponsored by jobsontheisleofwight.co.uk. If you're looking for work or if you're looking for staff, please call Jobs on the Isle of Wight on 01983 564 880.
This is Vectis Radio.
Have you looked at your carpets lately? Are they fit to be seen, or do they let you down? Or maybe they could really do with a freshening up to get rid of some of those stains and smells. Whatever the problem with your carpets, curtains or upholstery, you need ChemDry first. Call us for a quote on 295 518. No matter what the material, be it leather, cotton or silk, ChemDry first have the tools, training and experience to ensure they look their best. All cleaning products are 100% safe and non-toxic. Call 295 518 or go to www.chemdryfirst.co.uk to book a free quotation and claim your free can of spot remover. We offer a no-quibble money-back guarantee on every job, so you have nothing to lose. That number again is 295 518.
Andy Gustar has details of the £10 meal deal at Hamilton's Fine Foods.
Oh, that's been running for quite some time, and we're still doing it for £10, and I think, why change something that's really working well? You get a fresh chicken in there, 400 grams of steak mince, you get a pound of sausages, and you get a quarter of ham. All of that for £10. There's a lot of meals there for a family of two or three. The important thing to add to that is it's quality food as well. You must, I think, for the sake of your own health, look to a quality product which is going to be that good for you.
Hamilton's are in Newport, they're in Pyle Street. Where else are you?
We're in Cowes High Street, Wootton Bridge. We also have a shop now on Dodner Industrial Estate.
Hamilton's Fine Foods, the best local butcher in town.
The weekend starts early. It's Wham-Bam-A-Lama time. Your two-hour tonic of rock and roll. We're playing rockers, rollers, smoochers and doo-wop from that great era of music. So join me, the old boy, every Friday, 3 to 5pm, for a whole lot of shaking. Only on Vectis Radio. Goodness gracious, great walls of vinyl.
Stay social and get in touch. It's at Vectis Radio on Twitter. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
The Lunchtime Social Debate is sponsored by jobsontheisleofwight.co.uk. If you're looking for work or if you're looking for staff, please call Jobs on the Isle of Wight on 01983 564 880.
Hello and welcome back to Wisdom, Wit and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Ivana Popoff. I would call her a poet. She's having none of it. But just listen to her words as they wash over you, and I think you might agree with me. So, welcome back, Ivana.
Hello.
And you've got some more of your lovely work for us. Mm. And this particular one is around the theme of being true to yourself, which I think is a thread that runs through a lot of your work, isn't it?
It seems.
Yeah. So, could we have... I think it's called Death is Coming?
Yeah. It's called Death is Coming, and... It was written on a bus.
As a lot of your work is.
About 98% of my poems are. This is called Death is Coming. I was sitting on a bus one day when I noticed an arm. I should go back slightly. I was sitting on a bus one day, surrounded by white hair cut short, when suddenly my surroundings were flooded with 1,000 Finnish exchange students wearing matching T-shirts, branding stylized images of the sea. And steel-grey graduation caps. There was the boy I'd seen the day before, a little Finnish boy in a sea of Finnish girls becoming women. The boy's lips were still blue, from the blue ice lolly he'd been licking the day before, and he was wearing his graduation cap on top of a sun hat. His eyes glimmered. He looked even littler today, pale, snappable wrists, next to these swelling girls whose hairstyle seemed to have grown overnight. I was sitting on a bus one day when I noticed an arm, a sandy blonde arm belonging to the body of a Finnish girl. On her arm were the words, "Death is coming." My first thought was, refreshing. And then I began worrying about whether it was a tattoo or the scribblings of a biro in the hand of a child. If it was a tattoo, then what had she been through, this little Finnish girl? And if it was a scribble, then I knew who was behind it. That little Finnish boy, with the little blue lips, sucking on his little blue ice lolly silently, thinking of life. And death, how one was going, one was coming, silently sucking on his little blue ice lolly. It couldn't have been any of the girls. They had other things to think about, like the growing of their hair and posting of portraits on smartphones. I asked the girl, I think she thought I was crazy or disturbed or both, "Is it a tattoo?" I said. It wasn't. I looked at the Finnish boy and thought, hell yes. One day you'll be a rock star. People will pay you to stand above them. And your words, breathed from a miniature cherry blossom mouth, will be bigger than all of the sheep.
Brilliant. Thank you. When you're on the bus and you're inspired by the people around you to write, how connected do you feel to them in that moment?
I feel a bit weird in that moment because I'm watching them quite intently, and I'm thinking, like, I'm placing so much of my own experience on them. I mean, it's very possible that one of her friends just scribbled on her arm, "Death is coming," and that little Finnish boy with his little blue ice lolly had nothing to do with it, and actually he'll grow up to be, I don't know, an accountant or something. That's nothing to say anything,
but, yes, you know, yes,
maybe he won't be a rock star, So yeah, I'm placing so much of my own experience and what I would like to be seeing on what's happening in front of me, I think.
Have they ever caught your eye and then asked you what you were doing?
No, not yet. No.
So do you feel a bit stalkerish?
Definitely. It feels quite weird, especially with the kids. Like if I'm observing children on the bus, you can't help but have that in your mind, sort of, that you're like...
But I think we all eavesdrop, don't we?
We all do.
And we all observe and we all watch. I mean, a bus is quite claustrophobic. You can't get away from it. And they're very loud, aren't they? And I don't see how you can't be avoided.
Headphones.
Yeah, there is that. Yeah. But then, I don't know, I see these people with these massive headphones and it seems so exclusive and just literally in one's own little world and not sharing, not participating.
Yeah.
Not being part of the real world, you're just shutting yourself away.
Yeah.
I find, do you? I mean, what do you...
I think sometimes you need that, especially if you're in a city and you're faced with this, maybe it's going to be an hour or 2 hour commute every day in hot, crowded spaces. I think sometimes you really need that escape. And you could be engaging in something really worthwhile. Like I'm always imagining that people are listening to, I don't know, podcasts or... I don't know, informing themselves or something.
You have a really lovely elevated view of people. I just think they're listening to kind of music.
Oh, I don't know. If I see someone of a certain age with headphones, I imagine like what kind of classical music they might be listening to. It's very judgmental of me, I know. But
then I'm equally judgmental by thinking they're shutting themselves off from the world. I suppose I like to know what's going on around me. You know, if there's a big noise or I think I need to know what's happening.
I
need to have my ears, but so I'd lose myself in a book or a newspaper.
Yeah.
But the headphones, they're a total kind of wipeout,
aren't
they?
Totally. And it's... I don't know, I think it can be dangerous. I think you probably see like an increase of like, you know, people being run over crossing the road
or
bicycles with the increase of headphones that are being used. But I think, I think sometimes you need it. I personally don't, just because I would miss out on,
so much. You couldn't do your work if you were just locked off like that. And you also mentioned in that poem about smartphones, which in some ways, you know, they're a blessing and a curse, aren't they? But they're another way that of people using to absent themselves from the moment.
Yeah, I think like any tool that could be used for the good, incredibly practical and time efficient. But I don't know. I think there's so much to be seen out the window.
Yeah, and again, I think they're
a bit extreme in that. I don't know, I still haven't got myself a smartphone. I've still got a stupid phone.
Well, my smartphone's very stupid, so you're not missing out on anything. But I think when you have a smartphone, that you can use it to escape. You can use it, especially with social media, to portray... It's almost going back to this Barbie thing, another image of yourself.
Yeah.
So again, it's going back to what we were saying originally about painting on the smile.
Yeah.
It's painting on a very public smile and then posting that everywhere, isn't it? And saying, look how happy I am, look what great day I'm having.
Yeah.
And then one opens up their own Facebook page and thinks, but I don't feel like that at all.
Yeah.
But everybody else seems to be having a great time and being very successful and very marvellous. I don't know. I think there's a lot of covering up.
Definitely. But I think, I don't know if it's just the friends I have, but I've got a few people on my newsfeed, because I use Facebook regularly, that will post when they're having a bad day, quite a raw way. And there's something refreshing about that. I would never do that.
No.
I don't know. I still, something in me resists.
Yes.
Against
oversharing.
That. Yeah. But why not? Like, people post up pictures of themselves on holidays when they're feeling really happy. Why not put the other side of life up there as well, which is more honest and realistic?
Again, it comes back to that bravery thing, doesn't it? If you're prepared to put that up there.
Yeah.
It's a bit... I find some of the relationship sharing can be... Because then sometimes you can be back in a relationship, can't you? So you can... one could put up that you've been so upset and heartbroken, etc. Yeah. And then you know, put up all sorts of things, and then the next day be back in that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to think of the other person, don't you?
Yeah, and it's an odd one, isn't it? But I suppose I don't like that hiding behind it way of, as I say, painting on a very public smile. It's very dangerous.
Yeah, maybe we should start posting pictures of ourselves kind of like crying with a tub of Ben and Jerry's. Surrounded by tissues and like some grotty pyjama.
Maybe that'll be the next phase. That'll be the next sort of big thing that people will do instead of the big selfie smile.
They'll call it free book instead of Facebook.
So going back to the people on the bus who have inspired your work, would you like to, do you ever feel inclined to rip out the page that you've written, or in your mind want to share, if only I could share what I've just written with them at a later date?
Not yet, because I've shared one with a boy, a good friend of mine who I observed falling in love with a girl he was sat next to on the bus, and I've shared that one, and he really appreciated reading that because it reminded him of the moment 5 years ago. Apart from that one, which is quite a positive poem, which is quite straightforward, the other ones I'd sort of be a bit hesitant to share because they're all a bit darker.
Yes.
And I think also, like particularly with that last one, Death is Coming, I mean, this was a bunch of eight-year-olds.
Oh, sure.
You know.
Guys, older people, adults that had, you'd interpreted something in them.
Yeah.
And how you felt about if they came and were in your audience, how that would make you feel.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting, definitely. And if I wrote a more straightforward kind of poem, maybe I would. But I've got a few that are a bit dark, and I wouldn't want to.
No.
I wouldn't want them to know that they were the subject.
And I know you've got one that probably is less dark, about cucumbers.
Yes, yeah.
So shall we lift the mood and hear that one?
This is called Worrying About the Cucumbers. I was swivelling at a desk, staring through a set of double doors, when suddenly I thought of the cucumbers, lined up like damp, shivering soldiers on a polka-dot ironing board under my bedroom window. I said to my manager, "I'm worrying about the cucumbers," and my manager made a face like a brown paper bag being sucked in. "What?" I swiveled anti-clockwise to explain. "Last week I sowed a handful of cucumber seeds. They sprouted and climbed shiny for days, and then I repotted them just before this bad weather hit, and it's like the life has just fallen out." My manager shook her head. "I wish I had space to worry about cucumbers," she said. I didn't tell her that I worry about the tomatoes and green beans too.
Lovely. The last comment from your manager saying, "I wish I had time to worry about such things." I can just hear her saying that.
Yeah, and she did.
Yes, yes. And did you keep the job?
I've got the job. Hello, Lucy.
But I'm assuming, are the cucumbers and the tomatoes...
They're real. They're not an allegory for anything.
They're not.
No, I was really worried. They'd grown like beautifully on the edge of my window, and then I repotted them, and then this bad weather came, and then I came home from work one day and they were all dead, and it was really sad.
Well, it is.
But I recognised how privileged I was to actually have space to, you know, to worry about the cucumbers.
Yes, and people would say
how
that
fortunate,
well, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like, yeah.
But it was only in that snapshot in time that that's all you had to concern yourself with, I'm sure. But that was...
Oh, yeah. I think I was maybe distracting myself by worrying about...
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Is that more your way of dealing? I mean, how do you cope with those when life just gets too much and stress that we all cope with day to day, and people say we're far more stressed now than we've ever been before. How do you deal with that, Ivana?
For me, there's no other way of dealing with it than holding it, sort of allowing myself to, when I'm feeling low or like everything's too much or I'm lost, not sure what the point of anything is, to just hold that feeling with the knowledge that it will pass, like everything. And I can't rush it along. And sometimes it'll be with me for, you know, hours, days, weeks, months, but I think it's important to hold it and acknowledge it and acknowledge that it has its place, you know, that it's a valid emotion experience that you have to go through, and it'll be different, you know, it's not always going to be like that.
No.
Everything passes.
I think that's a very wise and astute way of dealing with it, and I think that's possibly what a lot of therapists, I've heard that way, that logic of dealing with it.
Mm.
But I think people struggle with, they understand why that makes perfect sense when they hear you say it.
Yeah, but actually doing it.
Doing it, yeah. In the moment when life seems to be sort of crashing down around your ears.
Then crying a lot.
Yeah.
And having friends that you go to and that say exactly what I said, you know, and pull you out of it with their words a little bit. And then maybe remembering what it is you love and maybe trying to do that even if you're still feeling rubbish. Like, I don't know if painting brings you peace or listening to music does. Or
does your writing bring you peace?
I can't write if I'm feeling low. I don't. My poems are only ever written in moments where I'm feeling like particularly alive. Where it could be an angry emotion or sadness, but I'm feeling something, so that's fine. If I'm not feeling anything, if I'm feeling it empty, then I won't write.
Have you ever tried to write in those darker moments?
Yeah, it's been very interesting.
And what's it? Real vomit.
Yeah, like splodge.
And have you shared that with anybody to get somebody else's reaction?
No, they're in my most private diaries. Locked away.
But as we were talking about earlier, when you perform the majority of your work, even though it can have quite dark, deep overtones, I always notice when I see you've got a smile.
It's positive, I think.
Playing there, which I think gives the audience permission to relax and enjoy. They know your work, although it is very deep, isn't going to disturb them.
No.
It's not going to... They're going to have a good night out without having too many dark, deep thoughts thrust upon them.
Maybe, yes. And if they want to read into them, then they can.
Yeah.
But I'm not... Yeah.
And I think because your delivery, you know, you've got this lovely, softly spoken speaking voice. Again, I think people find that very non-threatening, very reassuring, and possibly allows you to slip in these darker themes. But without being seen.
I've got a lot of depressing love poems. If you just take them at face value, it's inescapable that they're written from like a point of like despair.
All a bit Adele, are they?
Yeah.
Have you got any you'd like to share with us at the moment?
Yeah, I've got three very short ones that require quite a long title, which I'm just going to make up now because I haven't got it written down. The title would be Three Hopeless Love Poems, written about three hopeless men that I fell hopelessly in love with at the same time on the 25th of October 2013 in a decrepit sailboat in a dead-end marina in the north of Morocco. That would be the title. So
that's a poem in itself, though,
isn't
it?
Yeah, that's the title.
And one we can all relate to.
Yeah, I think...
Apart from the Morocco bit, I've kind of been there. Yeah.
What, being in love with many men at the same time?
Yeah. And it all been fairly disastrous.
So. Yeah, I'll have to talk about that one day. Okay, so one, hiccups. Oh, every time you hiccup, I think... you're beautiful. Two... on checking my inbox, how is it that the mere absence of a name can bring about a feeling of absolute hopelessness again and again and again? And three, it's a shame we met so young. I sometimes wonder if I will ever be content with someone that is not you.
And was that based on a real person?
Oh, all of them. Yeah, I could give you their names, but I won't.
No, don't do that. But who... So, in answer to that question that you posed at the end of that last line, have you found contentment with someone that wasn't him?
No.
And how long ago was that?
We said goodbye to each other the day before Christmas. So it had been When's Christmas? The
25th.
So it'd have been the 24th of December 2013.
So three years. Anniversary coming up. And
I know,
you haven't
it's a bit
found...
depressing, isn't it? We didn't even kiss.
But it was... And did they know how you felt about
it? Yeah,
them?
This is the guy that was like, oh, you've got balls.
Oh, this is the one?
Yeah.
Have you sent him this poem?
No.
Maybe you should.
No.
No. He wasn't feeling the same.
No.
There's nothing worse, is there, really?
No.
You think, how can I have got this so wrong? Because there should be a law of nature that says if you're attracted and love someone, then that should come back to you.
No.
Doesn't work like that, does it? Really doesn't
There's
work
no
like that.
There's no fairness in nature.
No, indeed. And the rest of the poem, how do you feel? When did you write that?
On the 25th of October 2013.
So you wrote that right at in that moment?
Yeah, in that crux where it was there was him, this boy that every time he hiccuped, I just thought, oh God, stop it, it's too cute. Stop hiccuping, because I was falling in love. And then that on checking my inbox was about, it was someone that I'd met about 3 years before that was still very much in my heart and on my mind.
Do you still think about them now, 3 years on?
Yeah, I do. I think once you've loved, you don't really stop.
No, I think if you've had those real powerful emotions for someone, you can't just let it go.
No.
It remains part of you, isn't
Definitely.
It? It's part of the makeup of your heart, I think.
Yeah, and especially if it's been unrequited, right? And there's been no chance to maybe after a week or 2 weeks or a month realise that they're actually a complete dingbat. Right?
There is, yeah, that's
They'll
always
remain kind of...
In a bubble. Yes.
You know, and then you carry them with you forever, and that's fine.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, the idea of realising that they're not as perfect as you imagine them to be. But yet we can't do that on our own, can we?
They need to, like...
Maybe other women can, if I'm maybe it's just you and me. But we need to see it with our own eyes, don't we?
Yeah, definitely.
And experience it. Mm. Rather than be logical and think, well, they can't have been as perfect as I imagined them to be.
And I've had that, you know, I was head over heels in love with a boy for about 2 years at high school, and then finally we went out. I was about 16. I think going out with someone at 16 meant, like, maybe talking on MSN after school. It took about a week to realise he was a complete plonk. That was refreshing.
When you do it, it's so liberating,
oh,
isn't
God,
it?
Oh, God, it's brilliant. Yeah. It's like, woof, wow, all that time wasted. Woof, okay.
I really want to go to the Ministry, I don't know what it is, of Unrequited Love, and say, oh, come on, I've given about. Well, yeah. Maybe, you know, if you add it all up, all those dates that, you know, never where you stood up, or all the pointless relationships, maybe 10 years, you know, that I'm now entitled back.
Back, yeah.
Yeah. With interest.
And what would you do with those 10 years?
That's really interesting, because now I'm really happily married. So I would want that time... I would want to go back. So I'm 57 now. I'd want to be 47 with my husband and have those 10
those
years
10
with
years.
Him.
Okay.
That would... Yeah, there would be justice in that.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. I wonder if one day, you know, we'll be able to do that.
Well, we can do so many... Machines. I mean, if we can extend our legs by breaking our femurs, then I guess we can do anything.
Yeah.
And that just brings me onto a news item I was just listening to. The guy in the Paralympics, I think his name was Alistair Brownie, who helped his brother over the finishing line. Did you see that?
I didn't. I've not watched any of the Paralympics.
It was just an item on the news, and it's been doing the rounds on social media because it was quite remarkable. They're running the same race, and his brother just crashes out onto the sidelines, absolutely exhausted. I don't know the length of the race. And then his sibling comes up and just picks him up and puts his arm around him, and together they hobble over the finishing line. And I just think that's, well, personally, I just think that's pretty wonderful.
That's really heartwarming, isn't it?
Yes. And it's brought up all sorts of discussion, because obviously neither of them won the race, because the brother who helped...
Yeah,
could have, I suppose, in theory, have gone on to win the race. Yeah. There was a possibility of that. But somebody else took the crown because the other one was too busy helping his brother up.
Okay.
So, And people have been criticising the guy who won it to say, you know, have some humility. You would never have won it had this not happened, you know, but you've taken this glory all for yourself when actually it was a bit of a fluke.
Yeah.
But I suppose so much of sport can be like
can
that.
Can be. And I mean, at the end of the day, he wanted to win. And the brother who helped his brother, is that right?
Yeah.
Was more concerned with, you know, this act of love
exactly.
for his brother than winning, and all the years of training sweat that had been before that, you know, were kind of inconsequential. So they both made a decision, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's... I just thought it was lovely. If you interpret it as being a lovely gesture... Mm,
definitely, and why not just focus on that
exactly.
rather than having to... I mean, that's what the media does, isn't
yes,
it? Why have
puts
to focus
all this
on
negativity out there.
The winner, you know.
And it was... I heard someone that was also saying, was it a form of cheating? But...
No.
Who? Neither of them won.
No.
So it was just an act of brotherly love at its, you know, at its best, wasn't it?
At its best, definitely. Because imagine the years of training.
And what would
your dream?
And what would have the, you know, people have been saying had the brother who was doing just fine kind of just sped on past, kind of waved at his poor brother, sort of panting in the gutter.
Yeah. We probably wouldn't have blinked an eye, actually. Like, yeah, well, that's sport, isn't it? That's
it's a really interesting concept, though, because, I mean, I don't watch a lot of sport, but I've never heard or witnessed anything quite like that.
Yeah, no, neither have I.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one, isn't it? And thinking that moral, your own moral compass, it's impossible to say what you do in those circumstances until you actually find yourself in there.
Yeah.
But to be at that level, and like you say, the years of training and getting up at God knows what hour.
Yeah,
to
protein shakes.
Yeah, and putting your social life and your normal life, whatever that is, on hold in order to achieve the goal. And then you find yourself racing against your own brother. Yeah. But I suppose, I don't know, I'd like to think I would do that under similar circumstances, but I'm not, I don't know that I could or would. It's an interesting one, isn't it?
I don't think I'll ever be good enough to be in a professional race.
So you'll never have that problem.
I will never have that problem.
But it's, I think it's interesting, and I think the negativity that it's brought up is equally, I mean, it's very sad, but I find that way people always want to do someone down or do a situation down instead of, like you say, celebrating what was just, I suppose, a bit of sacrifice there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, he sacrificed his chances of glory and greatness.
Yeah. Or maybe it wasn't even a sacrifice. You know, maybe he realised in that moment what was important.
Yeah.
And so then it was sort of just clear, like,
yes,
actually, this is all a game, right? And my brother's a real person.
Exactly.
And I have the opportunity to help right now.
And I think in life, particularly now, more so than ever, that kind of behaviour isn't necessarily applauded, is it?
No, it's not.
It's kind of integrity.
Not in the rat race.
No, exactly. Yeah. And that's what it's... that. In a way, that's... The games become, I don't know, the depiction of a rat race, don't they?
Yeah.
Harder, faster.
Yeah.
And being rewarded for that, in a sense.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, but I applaud you. I applaud you, Alistair Browning. I think you did a lovely thing.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how his brother's feeling today.
Probably, like, hopefully he's not feeling guilt. It could be very possible that there's space for guilt there. Hopefully he's just feeling brilliant.
Yeah,
you know,
I think,
wow, what a cool brother I have.
Yeah. And not thinking, you should have just left me there. Now look, you've let the focus, everybody's, oh no, you know, I could have just scuttled away.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah, hopefully not. Hopefully not.
You just never know, though, with people, do you? Like we were saying earlier, kind of acts of what we think are bravery and kindness can be reinterpreted to be interfering, demeaning, you know, patronising.
Yeah.
So
I hope not.
That
rings true.
I hope not. So going forward, where's your work going to take you next?
I really want to start recording poems, make a SoundCloud account. Maybe then I'll move on to a YouTube account. Who knows?
I think that would be wonderful. I mean, it all sounds so technical to me, Ivana, but it's easy, isn't it?
It is. I think I've got good friends that can help me.
Right.
Yeah, that have, like, you know, the equipment and I don't, because there are people who are already really good at this stuff, like recording and editing, and I'd rather use them than spend a lot of time learning how to do all that stuff.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Maybe one day I will, but right now I sort of feel like, ooh, it'd be much nicer if we collaborated, yeah. And then...
I would like to think that once you've established your SoundCloud and your YouTube account, that your work will go out there and someone somewhere will discover you and discover your beautiful work and give you the kind of enormous platform and showcase that your work warrants.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been really lovely, as always, talking to you. So yeah, thank you very much, Ivana Popov.
Thank you, Joan.